Corrin's mouth felt like a desert, and it wasn't just because of the dust created by the grater. He'd been planning his little experiment for the last 2 days, and was fairly certain he had a plan that would work perfectly. He'd found a rock on the grate, and now he held it lightly in his palm. Jan and Erlor knew what he intended to do, but a number of other prisoners had been recruited to stage the distraction that would allow him to act. Corrin looked over at Erlor, who, in turn, nodded to two men working with sledgehammers. One of them brought his hammer down on the ground hard, then loosened his grip so the tool cartwheeled away. The handle grazed another man who screamed, clutched at his shin, and started hopping madly, swearing he was going to kill the clumsy oaf. The worker shouted encouragement to the two men in hopes of goading them into a fight. Corrin clustered with the other, then stopped when Erlor and a knot of prisoners screened him from the guard. He looked at the rock, gave it a kiss, then hauled back and hurled it up toward the ceiling. "Come on, come on," he thought. His theory was that if the prison was oriented upside down, gravity generators would be operating beneath his feet to keep him in place. But the farther away from the floor he, or a stone, got, the weaker would be the generator's grasp. If his theory was correct, the rock would hit the ceiling and hold. The guards began shooting into the crowd. Stunned prisoners began to collapse in waves. Up above, the stone clipped a stalactite. It deflected off, still traveling upward. It seemed to slow. Two men forming Corrin's screen went down. Then Erlor twitched and fell. Down! To the ground. The stone fell up. The stunbolt's blue agony played over Corrin. Once again, every nerve in his body fired, every muscle tightened, and every joint creaked. But looking at the stone, he knew he was looking down, which meant things for him were definitely looking up. Nuora Venn looped a brain tail over his shoulder as he approached the witness.
Agent Wells, according to your earlier testimony, you've been auditing Imperial expenditures for years. Is that correct?
The Corrin's facial tentacles quivered.
I've said this, yes? This means you were looking for evidence of expenses that were hidden, black projects, so to speak, that did not appear on any official Imperial budget.
The Corrin nodded.
Budgets for such things are regularly hidden within other programs.
I see.
Nuora glanced down at his datapad. Now, you have told the court that Captain Selku was paid approximately 15 million credits over the past 2 years.
I indicated 15 million credits is all we have been able to uncover. The money is located in 6 different accounts. There could be more.
In all the accounts you've reviewed, how many Imperial agents have you found who have funds in 6 accounts?
The Corrin shifted slightly in the witness chair.
So far, none, but we have a great deal of work to do yet.
Nuora nodded.
Now, linking these files to one another and to an agent is not easy work, is it?
No.
Is one of the difficulties that Imperial Intelligence took pains to make it difficult to locate the identities of their agents?
Yes.
Do they encrypt data?
Yes.
Do the encryption routines vary in difficulty depending on the value of the agent?
Wells' facial tentacles rolled up and slowly unfurled.
Encryption does become more difficult the more valuable the asset. The methods used to hide Captain Selku's identity show him to be of middling importance to the Empire. And each of those other agents also had 15 million credits paid out to them?
The Corrin hesitated.
No.
No? How much were they paid?
Thousands.
So, you're saying that while Captain Selku was protected like an agent of little value, he was paid out of all proportion with his apparent worth to them?
That is one conclusion that could be drawn.
Is the other perhaps that he was set up to look like a valuable agent as part of a frame-up?
Hala Etik rose.
Objection. Speculation.
Withdraw. Agent Well, how much money has Captain Selku taken from his account?
None.
To your knowledge, is there any evidence that Tycho Selku knew the account existed?
No.
In the holding cell, Nuora leaned closer to Tycho.
Captain, we did score points today. I think General Medin will wonder about whether or not you're being paid off.
Tycho smiled. That's good.
In a way, yes.
What do you mean?
Nuora opened his hand.
The tribunal, at this point, has a choice. If they assume you betrayed the squadron because you were being paid off, or because you feared what Corrin would uncover, they can convict you of murder and treason without any problem. If they decide that you betrayed Corrin because of Imperial brainwashing at Lucentia, then they would be bound to find you innocent by reason of diminished sapience. In that case, you'd be placed in a hospital and treated for your affliction.
Tycho stared down at his hand. What you're saying is that the Sabacc cards have been programmed against me.
It's worse than you know. The Palpatine counterinsurgency front blew up a school. It's been 36 hours and they still haven't found all the bodies. Both humans and non-humans died in the blast. Someone from the PCF said that such acts of terror would continue until the state's sham trial of you, an obviously innocent man, was ended and you were set free.
What? Tycho shook his head. In court you showed that the imps had planted the information to frame me. And now you're telling me that they're saying I've been framed? What's going on?
Nuora explained.
Your trial is divisive. The government is using it to show they can handle things in an open manner, unlike the Empire. Imperial agents, on the other hand, are making it look like evidence is being trumped up against you. It makes humans think you're a sacrifice being offered to keep the Alliance together. The non-human population already thinks you're guilty and somehow responsible for the Krytos virus. It doesn't matter that you had nothing to do with it.
Tycho slapped his hands on the table.
Nuora, you have to let me testify on my own behalf. I can convince them I'm innocent.
The Twi'lek sat back.
You've been talking to Derek again.
He's convinced I'm innocent.
Nuora shook his head.
If you testify, Commander Etik will destroy you on cross-examination. She'll go back through your life and make it a mockery of what it's really been.
Tycho sighed. So, we need a miracle.
Admiral Akbar stood as Wedge entered his office.
Ah, Commander Antilles, welcome. I apologize for the short notice, but time rolls away as the tide.
Wedge smiled. I came as quickly as I could, Admiral. It must be important.
It is. The Zuckfra faction of Typhara has agreed to send us a substantial shipment of Bacta. Your squadron will be sent out to meet the freighter convoy in Alderaan Sector and bring it back here to Coruscant. We are having to rely on stealth and secrecy to safeguard the shipment. The whole matter of negotiations about all this Bacta has become very delicate.
Wedge raised an eyebrow. How so?
Apparently, the Typharans know we obtained some will from the Twi'leks, so the Vratex could use it in the top-secret experiments they are conducting. Some Typharans claim this was an attempt to circumvent them, and they wanted to cut us off Bacta completely. Cooler heads prevailed, so we're getting this shipment.
Akbar sighed.
While Zuckfra officials are willing to send us the Bacta, they are very wary of advertising the fact that they're working with the New Republic. They want this convoy to appear to be a private enterprise. It was suggested that Mirax Terek could take credit for it, and profit from it. They will get the ships to our rendezvous point, then we take over. You'll ostensibly be on a training mission and offer the escort as a courtesy.
Wedge frowned. Rogue Squadron is a high-profile outfit. We're bound to be watched. Why use us? The Mon Calamari shook his head.
You have a Typharan. It has been suggested that having Arisi Dilaret and Rogue Squadron guide the ships back here would prove to the Typharans that we appreciate the risk they are taking in supplying us with Bacta.
Kirtan Lur stared at the glowing holographic text hanging in the air in front of him and found himself poised between unbridled terror and unbound elation. The message offered him a way out from beneath Sliri Boru's thumb, but only if he took steps that would anger Asani Isod. The text carried an explosive message. Rogue Squadron was to meet a shipment of Typharan Bacta in the Alderaan system and guide it to Imperial Center. If Lur destroyed the convoy, he would advance the Imperial cause beyond even Isar's wildest dreams. He had only one problem. He wasn't supposed to know what the message said. The Imperial agent in Rogue Squadron had sent the message to Isar. and one of Lua's special operatives had retrieved it and brought it to him. Another problem was that getting rid of Rogue Squadron did not help him eliminate Boru as a threat. If, instead of destroying the convoy, he hijacked it to another system, he would have control of a very large shipment of a vital commodity. While Boru had a solid lock on the back-to-black market on Imperial Center, other worlds were clamoring for the medicine. If Lua used his supply correctly, he could enrich himself and betray Boru to the rebels. If he hijacked the Bacta, Lua knew Isard would find out. It was a question of how much time he had until she did. He carefully began to compose a message to her, telling her of his intent to create a duplicate Rogue Squadron to eliminate the convoy. He looked his message over, then prepared it for sending. No, he thought. If I send it now, she could countermand my order. I'll give her a day's warning. By the time she considers what will happen, it will all be done. And Kirtan Lur would be one giant step closer to being free. "4 minutes to reversion to real space," Nora then thought. He began a quick systems check on his X-Wing. Rogue Squadron's two flights, led by Lieutenant Pash Kraken, and including Gavin Darklighter and Riv Shield, as well as Nuara, was supposed to break off and head sunward to cover the tail end of the Bacta convoy. The last ship was to be the Pulsar Skate, flown by Mirek Tarek. One flight, with Wedge in the lead, would take the head of the convoy, and three flights was to orient itself toward any trouble. Not that there should be any. The Shards of Alderaan formed an asteroid field commonly known as the Graveyard. The majority of traffic into the sector came from Alderaanian expatriates returning one last time to see the sun beneath which they were born, and to leave grave gifts among the asteroids. Others came to plunder those gifts. I'd hoped to ask Tycho if he wanted me to leave anything for him, but I wasn't allowed any contact after I was debriefed, Nuara thought. He had recorded a message and saved it in the computer for Tycho in case he didn't make it back, but the mission was supposed to be little more than ceremonial. Aside from their timetable slipping by 3/4 of an hour because a fuel pump failure delayed their takeoff, the mission had gone exactly as planned. The white tunnel through which Nuara's ship had been hurtling exploded into a million pinpricks of fire. Some resolved into distant stars, but others refused to shrink. Suddenly, green darts stabbed into some of the brighter points in the system. Then those points exploded. "Fish spawn!" Nuara exclaimed. Wedge's voice came through his helmet comm unit.
"S-foil's in attack position!"
Errol Numb broke in.
"Caught a flash of something big heading out. A super star destroyer. It's gone. But in system, we have 2 dozen eyeballs, 2 Lambda-class shuttles, and a strike cruiser designated Termagant."
Wedge asked.
"What about the freighters?" "We just saw the last one explode."
Nuara gasped. "They're all gone?" Wedge addressed Errol.
"Any sign of the skate?" "No, Commander. There's no beacon from half the hulks on my scan. A super star destroyer has enough power to vape any of the ships in the convoy." "Right, right."
Wedge's voice trailed off, and no one spoke to fill the void.
"Blast! All right, listen up. We're going in, and we're going in hot. The strike cruiser is our primary target. Proton torps, dual fire. I want it down and out immediately."
Errol spoke again.
"I'm downloading data to everyone. Termagant isn't straight imp. It's allied with Singe."
Following Wedge, the squadron sped in towards Zinja's forces into the place where the convoy had been ambushed, out beyond the graveyard. Nuara watched his tactical screen. Because the TIEs were making strafing runs on what was left of the freighter, they had no unit cohesion. There was so much debris around where they were flying that Nuara would have been surprised if they had any clue about Rogue Squadron's approach. So the ambushers get ambushed. How fitting. The X-Wings closed fast as Wedge led them down and around the freighter debris field, then in at the strike cruiser.
"Rogues, launch now!"
On Wedge's command, the squadron fired their proton torpedoes in near-perfect unison. 22 torpedoes streaked in at the Lawson-shaped strike cruiser, coming up toward the ventral hull. The first couple detonated brilliantly against the ship's shield, but the rest pushed on through. Several exploded against the hull, shredding and blackening armor plating, while still more burst inside the ship. The Termagants began to roll, then the whole front half of the ship spun off to evaporate in the inferno the torpedoes caused. Nawara heard lasers gnawing at his aft shield.
I have one on my tail. I'm going to try to shake him.
He curled down into a corkscrew dive, but the aft scan showed the pilot pulling a twisting roll that kept him close behind. Nawara enlarged the gap between them and climbed again, but still the TIE pilot stayed with him. He started to head for the asteroids when something behind him exploded. He glanced at his aft monitor and saw no TIE there.
Thanks, Ibiki.
My pleasure, Six.
Errol Numb's voice broke in on the comm channel.
Lambs are running.
When Wedge answered, his voice lacked none of its earlier vehemence.
Thanks, 12. Let them go. We've got plenty to do here.
Rogue Squadron headed for the graveyard. A few of the freighters were still recognizable as such. Hull compartments had been blown open by explosions. Bacta that had geysered out through the holes had flash frozen. Fires burned deep in the hearts of several ships. Pieces of other ships drifted through the area, slamming into one another and breaking up further. Nawara keyed his comm unit.
Hypothetical question. You're part of a convoy with minimal arms, and you come out of hyperspace in the shadow of a Super Star Destroyer and a strike cruiser that's deployed at TIE. Do you provoke an attack?
The boss, Aesir Saloth, answered.
That would be suicidal.
Right. So you'd surrender and tell the SSD that you're hauling back them, which is currently very valuable.
Nawara frowned.
It makes no sense for anyone to have destroyed the convoy.
Wedge spoke.
I've just had word with Zinja's people. They're giving up. They were uneasy with the mission, and they don't like the fact that we've shown up. Pash, refuel at Tatooine and hire a freighter that can carry a dozen TIEs. Get it here and haul the pilots clear. I'm sure your father would like to debrief them, so bring them to Coruscant with you. Nawara, scan the debris. There's a lot of TIE parts out there, and...
Nawara looked at the readout on his screen.
X-Wing debris. But we didn't lose any.
No, we didn't. Of course, that's not what Zinja's people say. They say they already killed off Rogue Squadron, right here, defending the convoy the way it was supposed to. Then we arrived and showed them we were tougher to kill the second time around.
Nawara blinked.
But that makes no more sense than attacking the convoy in the first place.
No, it doesn't. But there's no time to try to figure it out now. We'll check for survivors here, then head back to Coruscant.
Even facing certain death at Esani Isard's hands, Lure did greatly admire how the woman had gotten him and Warlord Zinj and the New Republic in one simple set of maneuvers. Rogue Squadron would also have been caught in the trap had their operation not fallen behind schedule. And if I had not been playing my game. Within 24 hours of the ambush at Alderaan, Zinj had sent a message to Coruscant, indicating that he and his people had attacked the Bacta convoy because, according to his sources, the Bacta was tainted and would have exacerbated the Krytos virus problem. He further claimed that Rogue Squadron had been present, that they knew the Bacta was tainted, and fully intended that it should have been distributed to Coruscant to get rid of the Xeno trash the Empire had left behind. The only problem with this message was that it followed by roughly 6 hours a report that had been delivered by the government and included holographic images and commentary by Rogue Squadron. Zinja's claim that he had destroyed the unit was proved false. Lure shook his head. Isard had clearly leaked to Zinj the information about the convoy. Lure's own report that he was sending a false Rogue Squadron to eliminate the convoy would have arrived too late for her to inform Zinj. All this meant that the message that had been routed to Lure had also somehow made its way to Isard. She had acted on that message, then received his message later. The tainted Bacta story was an afterthought to mollify those who might be upset by the destruction of so much Bacta. And Asani Isard has, in short order, learned she can no longer trust him. Lure allowed himself to laugh, to banish some of his fear. He had plans to make. Big plans. Borsk Phalia stood behind his desk and smoothed the creamy fur around his face.
Please, Aesir Saloth, do come in. I am honored that Rogue Squadron's newest ace has time to visit with me.
The black and white furred boffin bowed her head respectfully, then stood at attention.
I am honored that a member of the Provisional Council noticed me.
Noticed you?
My dear, you are quite impossible to refrain from noticing. Aside from your performance in the squadron, you were positively stunning at the Dancrae party the other evening. You are well on your way to taking your place among the constellation of Bothan heroes.
Thank you, Count.
Phalia's face assumed a worried look.
Some among us, however, have become concerned about your liaison with the human, Galen.
Phalia purposely misidentified Aesir's lover and was rewarded by a flash of anger rippling the fur of her neck and head.
His name is Gavin, Gavin Darklighter. His cousin was one of those who died destroying the first Death Star.
And our martyrs died to enable the Alliance to destroy the second Death Star. Please forgive me if this mention of your personal life causes you discomfort. Xenophilia is not unknown among us, and your dalliance adds a hint of romance to your image. I fully understand the sort of bonds that can be forged between people who endure adversity together.
Aesir smiled.
Thank you, Counselor. Some other members of the Bothan community are positively imperial in their xenophobic attitudes.
I think I can help you with this problem. You were part of the mission to Alderaan, I recall, yes?
Yes, I flew wing for Commander Antilles.
I see.
Phalia pressed his fingertips together.
The timing of your arrival in the system has become a point of interest for certain conspiracy-minded individuals within the government and without. You were late, and the convoy was destroyed.
The younger Bothan's eyes narrowed.
If we had been on time, we would have been destroyed, just like the convoy.
Quite so. And it is a good thing you were delayed.
Still, you realize that tests on the samples of Bacta ice that were brought back to Coruscant do show the Bacta to be tainted.
In accord with Warlord Zinja's allegation.
Forgive me, sir, but those samples were blown up, flash-boiled and peppered with debris. That they show up contaminated is no surprise.
Under normal circumstances, I would agree with you.
What do you find unusual about these circumstances?
Phalia gave her an indulgent smile.
Clearly the convoy's timetable was leaked to Warlord Zinja, since the Zookra faction on Typhara has seen fit to send Bacta to the New Republic. It is safe to assume it was the rival Zoltan faction that tipped Zinge about the shipment. Even so, we cannot rule out the possibility that members of this government sabotaged the effort.
You can't be serious. That would make Mon Mothma or others out to be monsters who had sunk to Asani Isard's level or below.
Of course, I don't believe that is the case, but others do think it possible. It could be that certain superior officers see Rogue Squadron as a problem. Committing you in an action that destroys the squadron would eliminate that problem. I'm not saying this is what will happen, of course, but it could, and I would like to put some insurance in place that prevents this prediction from coming true.
Aesir's head came up.
What kind of insurance?
Phalia opened his hand.
I would like you to prepare a report that indicates the delay in Rogue Squadron's arrival was a product of human error.
Such a report could be used to strengthen the conspiracy theory,
Aesir objected.
If I were to use it in such a capacity, yes, it could. But I would never do that.
Never?
Aesir raised an eyebrow.
You know the Bothan saying, never means the right opportunity has not yet arisen.
Corrin pulled the double doors of the gate as far apart as possible, then squeezed through the opening. Although everything was going according to plan, he felt that some unmitigated disaster was lurking in the void just ahead of him. The imps who hung out near the mouth of the cavern hadn't bothered to comment as he headed down the dark corridor to the latrine. And 30 paces beyond the latrine, he had reached the gate. Now, staying low, he worked his way forward. When he reached the entrance to the mine corridor, he allowed himself a quiet sigh. He then inched his way toward the hatchway, leading into the cavern, and to his surprise, he found it open. To navigate through the darkness, all he had was the faint glow from the amber ready lights at the base of the floodlights used in the mine. He had mentally mapped them, and knew exactly where to head to get to the gravel loader. Orienting himself toward his goal, he started to make his way down the slope. Suddenly, he was hit by something, and pain exploded across the middle of his back, numbing his legs. He pitched forward and tried to tuck into a ball, but his legs ignored him. The orange glow illuminated the edge of the upraised shovel held by his attacker.
Nothing personal, Horn, but you're my way out of here.
Cerakote? How did you get past the gate? You couldn't have squeezed through.
The shovel remained raised over Corrin's head. I have money hidden away in numbered accounts. I bribed a guard for the combination to the gate lock, same as I bribed them for ingredients for my nectar. Very clever, General. Too clever to let you recover. Goodbye. The shovel began to fall. Corrin rolled to the left and felt metal bounce off his shoulder. He expected more pain, then heard Derricote gurgle and the shovel clatter to the ground.
Is he dead?
Corrin looked over to where the voice had come from.
Jan?
Yes.
How?
The older man came close.
I noticed that Derricote wasn't around. I assumed he was informing on you, so I came to stop you. When I saw him standing over you, I had to do something.
Corrin looked down at Derricote.
If they find him here, they'll know we know Lusankia's secret. Come with me. We'll drag the body off and deposit it somewhere.
Jan grabbed one of Derricote's arms and Corrin the other, and
they hefted him up on the safety rail. Then they upended him and let him fall.
Corrin, may the Force be with you.
Thanks. Until we meet again.
Corrin shook Jan's hand, then climbed the railing and lowered himself into the darkness. He stepped on Derricote's body, then scuttled under the conveyor belt. Where the belt fed into the engine drive compartment, he felt around the outline of a hole. He'd first seen it a week earlier when shoveling gravel out of the pit, and he knew it was what he wanted in the way of an escape tunnel. Corrin slipped into the hole. Down inside the drive engine compartment, he found himself on a steel grate catwalk. He crawled around, reconnoitering by touch. Finally, he found a light switch and punched it on. One dim panel provided illumination for the entire chamber. Corrin located a closed hatchway, then turned off the light again. He listened at the hatch, but heard nothing. Then he took hold of the hatch's handle and eased it back. The latch system squeaked, and Corrin was certain he had alerted all Imperial forces in the facility to his presence. Beyond the hatch lay a cylindrical corridor, roughly 3 meters in diameter. A red stripe of tile spiraled through it, starting at the center and ending up on the ceiling. Corrin started into the corridor and found himself stumbling. Waves of dizziness slammed into him as he tried to walk, and he became so unbalanced that he fell and ended up with his spine pressed to the red line. Of course, he thought. This has to be a transitional corridor. Gravity is directly oriented on the red stripe. It takes you from upside down to right side up. At the far end of the tunnel, he straightened. He passed through a utility room, then into a fairly opulent hallway which reminded him of images he'd seen of the Imperial Palace. Great. I escaped from prison to find myself in some Grand Moff's palace. Well, it's certainly better than the hole I was in. But getting out of here unnoticed is not going to be easy. Nawara Venn traced a talon through the ring of moisture left behind on the table by his mug of Loman ale. I shouldn't be here, he thought. This is madness. 2 hours earlier, he had received a message requesting the meeting. It had been signed Hesk Lilko, the name Ayella had given him as the alias Lynutka had assumed on his last trip to Coruscant. If the person he was to meet really was Nutka, the state's case against Tycho would fall apart faster than a Jawa fixed droid. Nawara saw someone enter the tapcast. The tall, slender figure wearing a hooded cloak cut through the crowd, then slipped into the booth. Nawara offered his hand. Nawara Venn. A pair of long-fingered human hands came out from beneath the cloak and pressed flat on the table. I know who you are. And you're not Lynutka. Nawara's eyes narrowed. Are you going to take me to him? No. Lynutka will not be coming. He is dead. What? Can you prove that? I cannot. I can, however, prove that your client was not meeting with Kirtan Lur on the night Corrin Horn saw him. I can prove it, because I am Kirtan Lur, and I was nowhere near Tycho Selku that night. In fact, I have never met him. You're lying. You can't be who you say you are. I can, and I am. I will testify on your client's behalf, provided the New Republic is willing to offer me immunity from prosecution for any activity I've undertaken on behalf of the Empire. They will pay me 1,000,000 credits, create a new identity for me, and get me off course again. But Nawara's mind was reeling. How can we be sure? Lur grabbed Nawara's hand and impaled his own palm on one of the Twi'lek's talons. A bead of blood bubbled up. Nawara heard the sound of cloth tearing. Then Lur blotted the blood with a strip of his tunic.
Take this cloth to Commander Etik. Have her duplicate my Imperial file, then run a DNA comparison. Once you're certain I am who I say I am, you will broker the deal for me. When you have made the deal, you will hold a press conference. You will field questions, and at one point you will say, I am very confident, supremely confident, that we will win. That will be the signal. I will then send you a message to arrange pickup. At that time, you and Ayella with Siri will get me. I don't want to see anyone else, just you and her. Corin squeezed himself in the corner of the library's cabinet and waited. He had been able to scout out the facility where he found himself and concluded two things. One, the lack of windows suggested the place was underground. Two, there had to be a secret exit. Aside from the tunnel back to the prison, the only other means of leaving was a lift that had a keypad and clearly required a code for operation. Unfortunately, his cursory survey of the area didn't give him any clues about what that code might be. His first impression of opulence had not diminished with his survey of the facility. The entire place had been decorated with golden brown wooden panels with hand-carved trim. Huge xenoscapes took up whole walls in some of the rooms. During his scouting run, a squad of 8 stormtroopers came up through the turbo lift. 2 men were immediately posted in the facility core. The remaining 6 broke up into 2 teams of 3 and proceeded to go through each wing, room by room. Corin had fled them as carefully as he could. Finally, he found himself in what appeared to be a very nice library. The shelves on 3 sides were lined with data cards. Both desks in the room had tabletop data pads with holoplates. The room did have its quirks, though. Stumbling about, Corin stepped into a circular design on the floor. Instantly, a 10-foot-tall holographic image of the Emperor was projected down from the ceiling and filled the circle. Seeking cover, Corin noticed a long, low row of cabinets beneath the xenoscape. He crawled into the narrow space. He heard the men enter the room, and one by one, they opened the cabinet doors and slammed them shut. He heard the cabinet next to his open. Clear! He pulled his legs up to his chest, all the time trying to project, there's no one in here. No one is hiding in here. It's all clear. The door of his cabinet opened. A light flashed in. It snapped off before it hit his face. It's empty. There's no one here. After they'd gone, Corin waited a little longer, then slipped from the cabinet. There had to be a way to get out. He turned his attention to the data pad, assuming they could provide some basic information to help him out. At one of the desks, he flicked the data pad on. He called up a system catalog and shifted to the Lysenkia database. Hundreds of names scrolled past too fast for him to read, so at the next prompt, he called up his own record. R1 was the code he'd been given, resistant in primary phase. The report went on. The subject could not be induced to fire upon positive icons, despite being subjected to their hostile intent in simulation. His resistance in the second round of testing occurred sooner than in the previous round. Subject is unsuitable for conversion. Isard was trying to make me into a monster, just like Tycho, he thought. She wanted me to become a tool she could use against the Alliance. He got back to an inquiry prompt and called up Tycho Selku's file. Finally, I'll have proof, he told himself. Tycho's file, too, was code R1. No way. That was my code, Corin thought. Though the subject's initial response to Imperial icons was positive, this appeared to be an artifact of his years at the Imperial Academy. It did not last long. Subject aggressively attacked Imperial icons. When those icons were overlaid with Alliance data streams, the contradiction caused the subject to become catatonic. Subject is unsuitable for conversion. But that's not possible. Tycho's a spy. I know it. Anger tore through Corin. He wanted to believe that Isard had planted this information to deceive him, but she had no way of knowing he'd get to where he could see it. Corin began to pace around the room. Lost in thought, he stepped into the circle in the middle of the floor. The Emperor descended upon him, and Corin jumped back, snarling up at the image. Quite the mess you created with your empire, you know. Corin realized that Isard had fed his hatred of Tycho, because it gave her a button to which she knew he would react. His hatred was unthinking, and she didn't want him thinking at all. Bits and pieces of things began to drop into place. By a simple process of elimination, He narrowed down the list of possible spies, and one name rose quickly to the top of the list. He looked up as the Emperor towered above him. This display does nothing but take up space. Then it occurred to him that it actually did more than take up space. It stops people from standing on this spot, he realized. Corrin stepped forward and oriented himself in the same direction as the Emperor. The world hazed out slightly as the holograph settled down over him, but out of the corner of his eye, he caught the momentary red spark of a low-grade spotting laser being shot at him. It flickered on and off a couple of times. Then the Emperor's holograph collapsed around him. As it did so, a circle of floor began to drop. The cylinder closed over him. Then a man-sized panel slid open in front of him. Through it, he saw the entry portal to a luxurious private tunnel shuttle. He entered the forward compartment of the shuttle. He had no idea how to program his destination, but at the top of the control panel, he saw a red button marked Return, and poised his hand above it. I don't know where this will take me, or how long it will take for me to get there, but anywhere is better than here, he thought. He hit the button, and sat back in the vain hope that he'd enjoy the ride.
I am very confident, supremely confident, that we will win.
Kirtan Lure smiled and killed the sound accompanying the holographic images of Nuora Vin's press conference. That's it, then. The Twi'lek had said the phrase. The New Republic would become Lure's new home. At his desk, Lure copied files from his desktop datapad to data card. Helvin, come here. One of his special intelligence operative cell leaders entered his office.
Sir.
Lure held the data card out to him. There has just been an announcement concerning the Selku trial that leads me to believe that there will be a fair amount of attention centered on the proceedings today. We shall take advantage of that. These are the plans and authorization for a strike at the largest of the Republic's Bacta storage areas, the one in the underground section known as Invisic. The agent frowned. The one guarded by Voru militia? Is there a problem with that?
No, sir. The target is no more secure than any other rebel facility. It is just that we have refrained from hitting targets he is guarding.
Indeed, Lure shrugged. An oversight on my part. Voru thought himself immune to our wrath. He learns now he was wrong. Never, in all the time Sleary Voru had secretly worked for Asani Isod, had he gotten a message that showed her close to panic. In addition to summoning him to a meeting place, her message directed him to dispatch teams of his people to various sites in the Imperial Palace and Senate Hill area. They were to go armed and shoot on sight the individual whose file she had appended to the message. He flicked on his datapad and called up the reports from the people he had monitoring Lure and his operatives. Of Lure there was no report within the last hour, when he had left his tower. The reports on some of his operatives, on the other hand, sparked Voru's interest. Three teams had congregated at the warehouse facility Lure used to store his heavy weaponry. That makes for a big operation. And I've given Lure no target, Voru mused. Then Voru realized that one of his facilities was going to be Lure's target. Ordering him to be in a meeting place at a specific time was meant to get him out of the Bacta storage area so he'd not be killed. Voru switched his comlink to a secure frequency and initiated a call.
Counselor Phalia, I have learned of an impending PCF strike at a Bacta storage facility. If we act quickly, a great tragedy can be averted.
A tone brought Corrin awake. A jolt of fear ran through him when he couldn't recognize his surroundings. He knew he wasn't in Lusankia anymore, or at least he hoped he wasn't. But the thought that his whole escape might have been some elaborate charade staged by Isar to break him down gnawed at his spirit. He hauled himself off the very comfortable Bantha-hide divan and opened the egress hatch. Waiting for him was what looked like a private lift. He entered and the doors closed behind him. The car ascended quickly, then stopped. The doors opened, whisper quiet. The musty scent of stale air rolled into the lift. Corrin peeked out and beyond a gauzy wall of spiderweb, saw a gray room with shadowy figures standing here and there. He ducked back, then looked out again. No one is moving, he realized.
As he stepped into the room, dust billowed around his feet. Slender web strands hung down from the ceiling like vines in a forest. Then he realized that all the figures were statues. As he approached the first one, a little light flashed on in the space before it and resolved into a hollow of a man. A voice from the base of the statue said,
"Avon Post, Jedi Master from Chandrilla, served with distinction in the Clone Wars."
Corrin looked up to see if the statue matched the holograph, but the white marble face had been destroyed. He moved deeper into the room. He couldn't explain it, but he had a hunch there was something important here, something he had to find. Intellectually, he knew that running far and fast was the best thing for him, but his father had always encouraged him to follow his hunches. Obviously, he was in some sort of Jedi museum. Some of the statues were missing limbs. Some had their eyes gouged out. All of them had been defaced. Corrin pulled some clothes from one of the broken statues, took off his filthy tunic, and put on the Jedi clothes. The rough-spun brown trousers and simple ivory tunic itched against his bare flesh. He pulled on the brown cloak and fastened it at his throat. A glint of gold in the case caught his eye then, and he stepped closer, sweeping dust from the glass with his hand. His mouth went dry. "That medallion, it's just like mine," he thought. His hand went to his throat to touch the medallion he'd worn since he'd inherited it from his father. He'd left it with his R2 droid, Whistler, for safekeeping before his mission to Coruscant. Mirax Tarek had identified it as Jedi Credit, a medallion issued in limited numbers to mark a Corellian Jedi's elevation from knight to master. Irritated that the holographic legend didn't play, Corrin jiggled the case. The image of a slender man hovered above the glass. A voice began.
"Naja Halcyon, a Jedi Master from Corellia, died in the Clone Wars."
The light from the projection bled into a static holograph. It showed Halcyon standing with a boy. The basic legend running down the edge of the image read, "Naja Halcyon and an apprentice." The projection snapped off and the holograph went dark.
That boy. That was my father.
Mirax had told him that the commemorative medallions were given to family, friends, students, and masters by the knight whose picture appeared on them. If my father had been his apprentice, that would explain how he got the coin. But he never said anything about knowing a Jedi. My grandfather did, but he never mentioned this Halcyon.
Corrin jiggled the case again, but the projection did not return.
Swaddling his fist in his Lusankia tunic, he hammered on the glass and shattered it. Looking around nervously, waiting for some alarm system to start blaring, Corrin plucked out the medallion and put it in his pocket. He was adding the holograph when the third memento of Naja Halcyon attracted his attention. He reached into the case and pulled out a long cylinder. Pointing it away, he hit the button. A silvery white shaft of light hissed to life and hummed. Corrin twisted his wrist around, bringing the energy blade through a set of interlocked loops. The sound quickened slightly as the blade transformed a strand of webbing into a drifting tendril of smoke. Suddenly, a sharp pop echoed through the complex of rooms. Three figures, all dressed in black, moved through the doorway. Corrin snapped off the blade, and having no other option, froze in place. Glow rod lights flashed over him, lingering only as long as they had on the other unmoving figures in the room.
"Nothing here," another said.
"Then we wait."
Wedge walked over to the circular holopad atop a pedestal in the center of the briefing room.
"We've only got time to go through this once, so listen up."
He hit a series of keys, and a holographic map of the Palix District and environs popped to life. The whole scene rotated up so the pilots could look down through the network of towers, tunnels, and causeways that clogged the Invisic area of the city. Deep in the lower reaches of the display, a red square pulsed with light.
"We have a report that the Palpatine Counterinsurgency Front is staging from this location for a strike on a Bacta storage facility. We are flying cover for a commando force that's going in. We expect speeder bikes, swoops, and speeders to be heading out of there. Since they used an airspeeder bomb to hit an earlier site, we have to assume that any and all such vehicles are moving bombs. Now hit the hangar and mount up. And may the force be with you."